Today is the day we celebrate in this country, at least as Father's Day. And since I stood here and spoke about Mother's Day, it seems appropriate that we ought to talk about the other half of the coin, at least a little bit, especially nowadays when there is this tremendous commitment to the feminine that is expressing itself, you know, politically, socially, artistically, just in every way that you can see. There's this push in one direction. It may be a necessary balance, given the cosmic play of things, but it's important that we can distinguish between what is eternally true and what is just passing through while God adjusts, makes the necessary adjustments to put this world in order. It's very difficult to live in this world without faith in God. Swamiji said it very simply, I don't know how people live in this world without a meditative experience of the presence of God within. And the fact is, people struggle. Even those who are deeply committed to the spiritual path, nonetheless, mere faith in God, mere understanding of karma, mere belief in reincarnation, more, you know, even being a disciple of a great master, is not a free ticket, or it's not a pass on all the demands of life. I remember once when I was visiting Swamiji in India, a woman came, there were people visiting Swamiji also, he was having a satsang, and this woman had come from a distance to see him, and she was a disciple, and she'd been initiated into Kriya. She was a serious devotee, but she was a very emotional person, and she was completely caught up in whatever the particular drama that she was involved in was. And I think it was it wasn't trivial. Difficulties with the children, difficulties with the husband, difficulties with the mother-in-law, difficulty with the mother, you know, just life has a way. Either people are unkind and exercise their unkindness on you if they have the power to do so, or they're kind and then they get sick and then you lose them, or the child turns out to have a different destiny than the one that you have been carefully planning for the child's whole life. Any number of things can happen. War, governments, all these things happen. It's very interesting in the life of Jesus. I always enjoy telling the story to the children because Mary and Joseph were all set with Anne and Jacob, who were Mary's parents, and they had all these plans for the baby that was going to be born. It was all so wonderful. And then the government intervened because the government demanded that there be a census of all the people so that the king could collect all the taxes. And that's how Jesus came to be born in Bethlehem. That's how he came to be born in a stable. You would think, couldn't the parents have made a better plan than that? But they had a great plan, except the government intervened. And all of a sudden, in the middle of winter, they're having to make this travel to a place where they have no home and they end up in a stable. I mean, even for the divine himself, this is the way of the world. It's this balancing of light and darkness, and we're always having to find our way through it. There's just no way around it. And this woman, when she was talking to Swamiji, kept repeating the litany of her troubles. And Swamiji tried to answer her by saying, well, I mean, he wasn't giving a long philosophical talk, but this was the conclusion. Now that you're a disciple, you understand that your life is in God's hands, and there's a purpose to your struggles, that he's teaching you. He's finishing karma for you, and he's teaching you things that you need to know. He's showing you your weaknesses, and in your very struggle, you will discover your strengths. As Master put it, God doesn't send tests to us in order to crush us. He sends those tests in order to awaken us to the infinite divine power that we have. So he kept trying to say to her, it's okay, you have a reason, you have faith. And as soon as he would stop talking, she would repeat the litany. Just there was no communication, at least in an external way, between them, until finally he went into a semi-sympathetic silence, is what I would say. I don't really know, I didn't follow up, I don't know whether she was disillusioned because he didn't sympathize, whether she rose to what he was offering, I don't know what happened. Swami tried as hard as he could, and then he gave up. Now, I was remembering all the many experiences I've had with Swami Kriyananda over the years, because he was such an interesting, I would dare say a perfect blend, of the yin and yang principles, which is the male and female. I prefer the words yin and yang, because nobody gets any political or social connotation when you say that. If you say man and woman, it gets really complicated almost as soon as you say it. If you say yin and yang, you're understanding there are two sides of one circle. It's the last symbol on my right here in our temple. If you look at it, it just looks like a perfect circle. If you go up to it, you see it's composed of two complete halves, and that you can't have the circle without the two halves. And in my experience of Swamiji, it was this wonderful blend, perfect blend, of masculine when masculine was needed, yang when yang was needed, yin when yin was needed. Master himself, because he wore his hair long at a time when men were not wearing their hair long, he didn't wear a beard. So if he'd worn a beard and long hair, it would have been obvious that he was a male. But because he wore only his hair long but no beard, he was an anomaly. And because we recognize gender by so many subtle keys that we're not really aware of, and Master didn't emanate any of those keys because he didn't identify as, he didn't identify really with his body at all, what to speak, of any limiting factor of gender. And so oftentimes people really couldn't tell whether he was male or female. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but many people have. You'll have a picture of Master with his long hair somewhere, and someone will say, oh, is that your mother? Or is that your grandmother? Or is that your girlfriend, depending on what your context is. When Rajasi Janakananda first met, that was a James J. Lynn when he was still living as a businessman in Kansas City. And the story of his first meeting of Master is there was a big poster because Master was speaking in Kansas City, and it was perhaps that picture that's on the altar now, but it was one where Master looked like that. And Rajasi didn't know whether he was looking at a man or a woman's picture. He just thought it was an extraordinary individual, and he couldn't quite put it together. Master tells the story himself of sitting on the train and having one of the porters walking back and forth and just not being able to tell. And finally, just in confusion, he said, is you a man or is you a woman? And Master, in the deepest voice he could, said, what do you think? Like this. I think Master enjoyed it. Master tells the story of asking where the restroom was and being directed to the ladies' room. And when he walked in, all the ladies began to scream because they recognized him as a man, apparently. And he comes out. And then he goes into the men's room and they think he's a woman and they start sending him out. You know, it's just, this is what we really are. This is where we live. When Swami Kriyananda, we had this product for a while. We still have it. It's called the Secrets books. They're these little books like this. Believe it or not, when Ananda first published those, no one else in the New Age field, so to speak, had thought yet of just putting out books of aphorisms. It's pretty obvious. But we were the first. And Swami's Secrets books are very, very good. If you haven't looked at them, I highly encourage you to do. Just 30 or 31 sayings, one for every day of the month, on many subjects: meditation, love, friendship, persuasion of all things, which is really communication, emotional healing. Just he put so much in so few words. They were huge. I guess the word is cash cow, which is a very strange word. You get these sayings going. But they were making a lot of money for Ananda at a time when we really needed it. They were a very good product. And the salesman for it says, look, almost all these books are bought by women. Even if they're gifting them to men, they're all purchased by women. Why don't you write a Secrets for Women book? And Swami said, I can't do that. I couldn't possibly do that. Even if it would be a good seller, I don't see how I could do it. Then he said he woke up the next morning and his consciousness was entirely feminine. He just felt like a woman. And for 3 days, he sat and he wrote Secrets for Women. And he said, and during that time, when people would ask him questions, he found himself unable to respond because he didn't have the male side of him, the masculine side of him, to respond with. So after 3 days, he finished this book. Now, you must understand, Swami was the least chauvinistic, the most gender-neutral person I have ever met. I mean, he didn't really even most of the time know whether the people around him were men or women. I'll put a little piece in this. He was walking down the street with Nirmala, who is a female, and there was a dress in the window that wasn't very attractive. Swami turned to Nirmala and said, "If you were a woman, would you wear that dress?" And Nirmala said, "Well, as it happens, sir, I am a woman." You know, because that was sort of like, he just wasn't thinking. It was an abstract question. "No, and I wouldn't wear that dress," she added. But Swamiji, after 3 days of writing that book, he said to a lot of his female friends, he said, "I was completely immersed in feminine consciousness." And he looked at us so sympathetically. "It was terrible." He said, "All these moods and these whirling emotions." He said, "I don't know how you all put up with it." He said, "I'm just so glad back to being a man." Now, I remember when during an earlier phase of my life, when I often had to do a lot of couples counseling, and there was a period of time, and I guess maybe God wanted me to get the point. Usually, of course, it's the woman who comes, you know. Sometimes the couple will come together, but usually it's just the woman. That's just, and this is what the difference between feminine and masculine is. And the woman would come to me, and she would tell me that her husband was so wonderful, he was so good, he was so kind, he was all these things. He was almost perfect. But of course, he wasn't perfect. That's why she was there. And the problem was, he just didn't relate to his feelings the way she wanted him to relate to his feelings. He wouldn't talk about them. He wouldn't engage in them, you know. He wouldn't take her seriously. He got tired of her. And after a while, I figured that what they were telling me was basically the difference between male and female. And it's about this much, you know. And I knew for a fact that if he moved over that far, then she would come to me and say, "He's so moody, he's so weak, you know. He never gets anything done, you know. All he just wants to do is process." You know, it's just like, you know, welcome to the human race. Because what we're all trying to do is we're just trying to get to that point in the center. Two sides of the same coin is how Swami talks about it. You just can't have one side without having the other side. The symbol of the female is the moon. And the moon waxes and wanes and waxes and wanes and waxes and wanes. Every single day you look at it, it's slightly different. And the female always knows just exactly how slightly different it is and how it changes and how the perspective is and just, you know, goes like this. Now that's wonderful. Because the female energy, forget woman and man, the female energy knows what's happening around her. The female energy can adjust to all these nuances of change. It can sense, and it's motivated to respond because it matters. You know, it matters how people feel. It matters whether the things are just exactly right. It matters whether we take action when we need to take action. The man is the sun. And the sun just, you know, it changes, but it changes very slowly. And it tends to rise and set more or less in the same place, and it comes up looking just the same way. And so where the woman is looking on the ground at all the little things, the man has his eyes on where we're going. And of course, if you don't keep your eyes up on where you're going, but always on the ground, and now the moon is full, and now the moon is small, and now the moon is full, and now the moon is small, you're just always like that. But the male energy keeps you going. Now, of course, what we're trying to work with is to have both. And that's what we always saw in Swami Kriyananda. He was able, in whatever circumstances were needed, simply to draw on whatever was necessary. His point of view was simply, how can I serve? And I want to just talk about that for just a moment. I remember I grew up in a household where people didn't raise their voices. My father especially liked to keep things really calm, and my parents had a very strong rule, which I really appreciated, which was they presented a united front to us. They didn't, if they had disagreements, they didn't present them in front of the children. And it wasn't insincere, it was just, it was nice, it was protective, and I always felt very confident in their connection with each other. But as a consequence, I rarely saw people argue, and I just didn't feel comfortable when people raise their voices at all. But at a certain point in my life, when I was about 18, 19, 20, I began to realize that my calmness was based on fear. It wasn't really based on transcendence, which is a huge difference. So I learned to speak louder, and I learned to express my feelings. I was living in New York for the summer, New York City for the summer, which is a great place to learn this, because what is really rude in California is everyday life in New York City. So I could be quite, to me, just outrageous in my behavior, and nobody even thought anything was happening. So it was a very good place to practice. And I got used to it. I got used to being less alarmed when people were that way. And I remember a number of years later, I was working with a friend of mine whose upbringing was entirely different. She was one of three daughters. She said she couldn't remember a dinner that didn't end with one of the girls bursting into tears, screaming, leaving the dinner table, going upstairs and slamming the door of her room. That was just like normal. You know, somewhere between the first course and dessert, one of them would leave the table. That was just the way it was. So she and I were working on a project, and there was a tremendous amount of tension in the project, and she began to get really upset. And she started fighting with me, you know, just criticizing what I was doing, protesting like this. And she started raising her voice. And I had the most interesting experience thinking, oh, she needs to fight with someone. I think she should fight with me, because if she fights with someone else, it could go really badly. So she starts yelling at me. I start yelling at her. She raises her voice. I raise mine. She says something insulting. I say something more insulting, you know. And pretty soon we crested. She was done. We all just settled down, you know, and then we cheerfully went back to our work like this. But it was such an interesting experience for me, because God needed someone who could do that. And if I hadn't learned how to do that, I couldn't have served. And she's a dear friend, still is. And, you know, she just needed it. So I was there to give it to her, because I had overcome my own limitations. So in life, you know, sometimes what people need is to be drawn onto your lap and just hold them, sympathetic clucking noises, you know, just supportive. They don't want the news. They don't want what we used to call true but irrelevant spiritual advice. You know, it's not the moment. They just want to be sad, and they want somebody to know that they're sad. You know, and I've watched Swamiji. The phrase sympathetic clucking noises is actually what I watched him. I realized that a lot of times he doesn't really say anything, but you feel somehow like he's heard you and that you've understood. And at other times, if it's what's required, he can just be as masculine. He can just give you as that kind of energy. I was remembering this story, which I often block out because it was so strange. I don't know if I ever got it into a book or not. This was, I think, the most extreme example. Now, what? I can't remember what it was that upset me, but a lot of things upset me. And so I was having one of those experiences. Oh, I know what it was. I was working on, oh, yes, I remember now. I had this long history where Swamiji was trying to teach me to write. And I was born, I don't know what happened to me in some previous lifetime over writing. Most people are afraid of public speaking. I was never afraid to stand up and talk. But make me write something, and my brain went, really, it went to Hawaii. It just checked out completely. Or went into Hades is actually more likely. So I had a very phobic relationship with writing. And that's why, among other reasons, the writing of this book has been such a victory for me, because this has been a lifelong karma to get over this phobia. So I was in this phobia, and periodically Swami would give me writing assignments. And I just, now that I think about it, I mean, I would just take the simplest assignment and blow it up into this life trauma that was, you know, that I need 6 months to write a 2-page article or something like that. So he'd given me one of these, and I was struggling like crazy to get the darn thing done and not being able to get it done. And so finally I went to Swamiji and I just put myself in. I remember I was in a pathetic heap on the floor, and he had been talking to me, and I'd been just wailing and weeping, and I don't even know what I said. But I was basically just saying life would be easier if it weren't so hard, which is something I actually said to him once. But it was this before I had it articulated, you know, just why is life so difficult? Why is it life so difficult for me? Is there anything we can do to make life less difficult for me? And I was just, and he tried to help me, but I couldn't hear any of it. And then I must have had my head down. It must have been like this. because I suddenly realized that he had gotten up from his chair and he had moved over to another part of the room and he was opening a drawer and he was messing around with something. Now, I was his housekeeper and his secretary, so I knew what his house was. I took care of his house and I knew what was over there. Now, this was before we had electricity and before there were, you know, at night it was totally dark. And there were no electric switches. We just had gas lights and propane lights, Aladdin lamps, kerosene lamps. So you couldn't just turn on a light at night. So a flashlight was a really important part of your life. We were also impoverished, genuinely impoverished, and flashlight batteries were a major life expense. So batteries would wear out a little bit, but they wouldn't quite be dead, but they'd be a little bit weak. And so we'd put them in this drawer. I say we, but in his house, we put them in this drawer. And then eventually, you'd sort of sort through and find out which ones were still usable. I mean, they would just accumulate. Like, who would spend time testing your flashlight batteries? It was a job you did, you know, at the worst, useless moment of your life. Swami is over there testing flashlight batteries. I'm having the crisis of my incarnation. And he's over here finding out which of his batteries are working. You know, it's like I was incredulous. You know, it's just like I looked over at him and it was like, how could you? How could you do this to me? But he was just doing that. So I had to just sit there for a moment and I tried to re-engage him in my life drama and he was not interested. So I finally just had to get up and go home. You know, I lived about a quarter of a mile up the hill. Man, and it was really interesting because first I was really mad. I was just mad, like this. And then I got home and I was so mad. And you know what I decided? I'll show him. And I sat down and I wrote the article. And it was good. He himself said, excellent, very good work. I knew you could do it. Yeah, like, I mean, we need that. We need that. If he had been too sympathetic, if he'd been too motherly in that moment, as he has been at other times in my life, I don't think I could have broken through. You know, it's powerful intuition that we have to understand. We have to understand it when we're working with others, and we have to understand it when we're working with ourselves. We can't allow ourselves to become too enamored of either side. You know, this is the great scary point that we're getting into in our culture, that in order to fix a lot of historical abuse, all of a sudden people have begun to create new historical abuse. You know, it's tough to be a young man in this culture right now. A friend of mine who's just a college student, he said, you don't even want to tell a woman that, you know, you like her hairdo. You just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's a real serious issue. They're just paralyzed like this. And all of a sudden, women are attacking young men for, you know, what's happened in Afghanistan 100 years ago. The poor guys are just, like, sitting there. They don't know where to go with all that energy. I mean, I'm not going to get real political here, but we just really need to keep our common sense going here. And we have to actually just lift it up and ask what's trying to happen. What's trying to happen is what's always trying to happen. We have to have balance. That's all, just balance. Because everything is God-given. You see, we have to have God in the equation. But what people are doing these days is, my ego has this preference, and I can tell you why it's a good preference, so my ego preference gets to rule. And sometimes somebody's ego preference is a little kinder than somebody else's ego preference, you know, because this is a mixture of light and dark. But the only way to really solve this is for all of us to go up into the light. We need all of us to be looking upward. And all the chaos that's happening now is for that to finally come through. We're going to get to play our ego story out to the end and, you know, make a big mess of it. We're already making a big mess of it, and the climate, the planet, the this, the that. And it's all just terribly scary, unless you know that somebody's in charge. unless you understand that we chose to be here because we get to have this adventure. You know, you go to the school, people take on, like, people spend all this money to climb Mount Everest, which, from what I can tell, is a very unpleasant experience. You know, it's like you're not having a lot of fun when you're doing it. But in the process of doing it, apparently, you gain something inside yourself that is worth all that unpleasantness. And really, all you've done is stand at the top of a mountain. But what you have done is you have mastered a great many limitations within yourself to be able to do it. And so that's the whole story here. That's all. This is all one huge Everest expedition where the actual end result, it's just like then you have the next morning and it goes again. It's not like the planet ever finishes and we finally say, well, that planet is done. You know, it's not like that at all. It's that we're here because in the process of trying to bring it to that point of perfection, we perfect ourselves. And then when you have that, you really have something. And this is who we're all trying to be. We have Mother's Day and we have Father's Day. We have yin and we have yang. Because the gender of this body, if you were a woman, would you wear that dress? Well, as it happens, I actually am a woman. And as it happens, I am not. I mean, I'm not even human. None of us are. We're all a manifestation of the divine. And all that we're here to learn is how to be perfect in that. Master's wonderful phrase, and Master did come to teach us about the feminine. He did want us to understand that God is compassion. But we mustn't ever forget that God is also impersonal wisdom. And, you know, that poor woman coming to Swami about all her life misery, he's giving her impersonal wisdom. Yes, I know you're miserable, but here is the impersonal reality. And if you can, in the midst of what you have to do here, hold also unto that, that is also your freedom. You know, in the midst of paying attention to the ups and downs of the moon, keep your eye on the spiritual eye. Keep your eye on the sun. And remember where you're going. And then, no matter what this does, you'll be free. God bless you.
John renouncing all, left his home, wrapped in solitude, far from men's ways, roaming across desert sands, seeking God's truth. Long years he spoke only with God, till silent of soul, wisdom did fill the ache of his heart.